Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. And thank you all. Everybody, welcome to AnCast. I'm Zach Birchie. Hope is here.
Hello.
And joining us for yet another series discussion here on the old AnCast, it's Ashley McDonald from the Podigious podcast.
That is, it's like prodigious with an R removed.
Yeah, right.
Without the R.
It's a lot of puzz. I don't want to pop my P's. Anyway, you can find that at podigious.com. Ashley McDonald, thank you so much for coming on to talk about Escaflowne with us.
Yeah, I'm super excited. I think I've been waiting 15 years for this moment.
To talk about a show.
Yeah, to talk about Escaflowne on a podcast.
All right, well, we're gonna break it all down. We're gonna talk about both the series and the film, which we actually revisited just last night.
Mm-hmm.
I think
me
you
too.
Had a,
yeah,
you had a much like foggier memory of it than I did.
Right. I was like, I don't know what happens in this movie. I was like, I know scenes. I know the village scene. I know the blue arena scene. And I know the first battle where Alan and Vaughn fight. I don't remember anything else. And then I saw the movie and then I remembered why I didn't remember.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to it. So we always start the same way, which is we discuss how we experienced this show for the first time. And in other words, how you came upon it, how you were exposed to it, and really your initial reaction to it. And Hope, I actually want to start with you on this one.
Okay. Well, I saw it. Basically, I was asking people. I was just getting into anime more. I was 16. It was 2006. So I could track my age very easily, being born in a year with a zero in it. So
yeah.
I was really getting into anime. I liked Bebop a lot. I liked FMA and Trigun and Samurai Champloo and stuff like that. And so it was all Adult Swim stuff. And I said, well, what is there that's available on DVD? I said, I have some extra cash. What's available on DVD that's good, that's a classic? And people said Escaflowne. So I bought Escaflowne on Bandai's like brick box DVDs, and I just churned through it really fast because it was really good. And then I discovered I discovered fairly far in that it was actually age-appropriate for my sister, who was 8 at the time, 8, 9. I was like, oh, this is like, this, she can watch this. Because most of the anime that I watch, she can't watch it, but she's super curious about it. So we watched that together, and a lot of my fond memories revolve around reacting. Specifically, one thing that's burned into my brain is there is a character reveal close to the end of the show where one character turns out to be another character in a very upsetting way. Like, they chose a very upsetting way to portray this twist. And I remember me and my sister, like, gasping really loud and being, like, really upset by it. And, yeah, the whole thing was a blast to watch, and I loved it a lot. So, yeah, that was basically my reception to it, and I've rewatched it many times since then, but not in several years. So it was still kind of fresh coming back to it for the podcast.
Okay, and Ashley?
So I actually saw it when it ran on Fox Kids back in...
Okay. Yeah.
2000 or whatever.
Right.
And so when I initially saw the commercials, I was like, this show looks silly. And I was like 10, to be fair. But then I watched the first episode and was just like completely hooked. I mean, it was actually the second episode because Fox Kids. But so then, you know, it got taken off of Fox Kids. And since I was only 10 and had like no money, it took me 2 years to get the whole like VHS box set thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then I watched all that. By then, the movie had come out, so then I was super hype about, like, getting the movie. And so, yeah, I just was, like, totally blown away by it when I saw it for the first time on Fox Kids, and then have rewatched it, like, every year since then.
Wow, okay, so the Fox Kids broadcast actually got you into it, and then from there, so you didn't seek out tapes of that version. Like, how did you discover that it was an edited, like a heavily edited version of a Japanese show?
I don't remember exactly how, but I do remember eventually, like, going to, what was it, Suncoast Video or something?
Yeah. Right.
And so Fox Kids had actually released a VHS version of their edited ones, but then going to Suncoast, I think they had the actual ones, and I was like, oh, this is different. I need to buy the first one again to have the first actual episode.
Yeah.
That's and I mean, like, the internet was helpful in discovering those things at the time, too. Right. Although I was not as plugged into the internet as we are now, obviously.
Right. Right. So I'm old, and I saw Escaflowne when the fan sub tapes were coming out. So roughly a year after Japanese broadcast, 97-ish.
Yeah.
We were getting the tapes at my anime club. It was one of the first things I ever saw at anime club. I believe it was the third episode. And it was a packed house. People were sitting in, like, hushed silence and reacting to everything that happened in the episode with, like, gasps and laughing and stuff. You know, and a hyped-up audience for this show, which at the time, really no one had seen anything like it. And I certainly hadn't. I, like, immediately fell in love with it, and everybody was all hyped up about it. So I that was the impetus for me to start doing my own fan sub VHS trading, like, in the late 90s, mid to late 90s, and got the show that way. So I got it as it was coming out. I remember getting the final VHS tape of the last four episodes and, like, rushing home, like, running home from school to, like, jam this thing in the VCR. Mm-hmm. And I was in high school at the time. And, yeah, it was formative for me. And, I loved it then. I saw the movie when it premiered. It had its world premiere at Anime Expo. I was there for that. Yeah, this show is really formative for me. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. But it's been a part of my life as an anime fan for my entire adult life. So it means a lot to me. The show means a lot to me. And
so we were, like, all introduced to it, like, pretty young.
Yeah, it was. It sounds like it was formative for everyone in different ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, that having been said, I have not seen it in, geez, I don't know, 5 years, 6, 7 years, maybe longer. Mm-hmm. So I revisited it for this podcast and did not really remember anything about the second half of the show. It started coming back to me as I was watching it, of course. But, yeah, so revisiting it with fresh eyes, well, I have a lot to say about it. But let's just get to the beginning of the show. I feel like you can cut Escaflowne in two. There's two distinct halves.
Yeah.
And it's important to point out, there's a lot of production trivia about this show. One really important thing that informs how I think people should look at this show is that it was designed to be 39 episodes long. Right before they started production, the budget was slashed, and they produced a 26-episode show. Mm-hmm. This becomes wildly evident later in the series. It was also originally going to be directed by the guy who directed G Gundam. Mm-hmm. It was going to be a very typical shonen show with Hitomi was going to be an idiot with big boobs, and she was going to help Vaughn and his robot. And that was how the show was going to go. Mm-hmm. Then Shoji Kawamori and the woman that is largely responsible for changing a lot of this stuff around, her name was Kazuki Akane. Mm-hmm. She came in and added a whole bunch of shoujo stuff to it, and the show is, I think, obviously better for it. You can actually see the shonen version in the manga. There's a manga that does follow what the shonen version would have been. That manga,
it's so bad,
sucks. Yeah, it's so really bad. Tokyo Pop released it here. It's bad. Mm-hmm. So that's important to know. And then, you know, it does split cleanly, I think, into two halves. Let's start obviously with the first half. Did you, let's see here, Ashley, did you want to run us maybe through the first, you know, five episodes or so, like, just the general, in general, the story at the beginning?
All right, I'll try.
Sure.
So in the beginning, it's like, there's Hitomi, she has a bunch of friends, she has a crush on a guy, she also has fortune-telling abilities with tarot cards. So she eventually sees a vision of Escaflowne, which is what the show is named after. because the full title is The Vision of Escaflowne.
Right.
So then her visions eventually come true when she's trying to confess her love to her senpai, who's going to leave soon. And she runs into Vaughn. They fight a dragon. They get transported back to this magical land of Gaia, which is, like, at war. Quickly becomes evident because Vaughn is a king of a kingdom called Finalia, which gets destroyed by his brother, who we find out in the next episode is, like, behind these attacks. It's basically just a lot of people coming together. We meet up with Alan, who's a knight in Asteria. We meet up with, like, Princess Malerna. She's the princess of Asteria. And it's just, like, a bunch of them coming together, figuring out that their evil enemy is Zybok. And they're trying to figure out, like, what is up with that. And they awaken Escaflowne, which is a giant mecha that only Vaughn and his brother can pilot because it's connected to the royalty of Finalia.
Right. And the first half or so is basically a very long chase sequence. Because it starts out in Finalia, where Delandau, who is the psychopathic sort of...
Yes, how could I forget about Delandau?
The best character.
The best character in the show, I think, hands down, is Delandau. Sort of the psychopathic head knight, I guess, of Zybok, which is this big sort of Star Wars-like evil empire.
There's a name for what he is. Like, they give them weird names.
I can't remember.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Falcon's title is Strategos, which I thought was a really cool title.
Yeah.
It just means I make the decision and I send Delandau out to burn things. Delandau has a different title, but...
I think he's just, like, the head dragon slayer. Is that...
Something. It's not really important. Yeah. anyway, so they burn down Finalia trying to get this thing. They meet up with Alan. They seek refuge in another kingdom. Zybok shows up there, and they're basically chasing Escaflowne. They're doing all of this because inside the floating fortress, Falcon, Vaughn's brother, has a big old tube TV that he uses to talk to Isaac Newton.
Yes.
Who,
okay. So, that sounds a little weird.
Spoiler.
It's Emperor Dornkirk at that point in the story, and he's basically saying he's trying to see the future. He's trying to create the perfect destiny for himself and basically... bathe Gaia in cleansing fire and start anew. Mm-hmm. And the dragon is clouding his vision. So he's basically seeing this dragon, Escaflowne is the dragon. And so they're chasing it to get it out of the way, basically, and put it under his control so he can seek his perfect future. Mm-hmm. What they're actually chasing is Hitomi, who can not only see the future, but she has the power of divinity, divination. So that manifests itself early in the show as she can see invisible Gaimalefs, which are the robots. This show is really complicated. Which are the robots that everyone's piloting. So Zybok has invisible robots that Vaughn has to fight. Hitomi can see them using her magic pendant.
She can see lots of things.
She can see lots of things, but that is the chief action mechanic in the beginning part of the show, is that.
Yeah,
right.
That's basically the first half of the show. Mm-hmm. They are chased from place to place until they land in the Duchy of Freed, where
in the Duchy specifically?
Yeah, that's Duchy. That's the name of a kingdom that's ruled over by a duke.
Oh, well, I... Yeah. I thought the Duchy was the name of, like, a duke's relative, but never mind.
Whatever. Anyway.
I'm wrong. Excuse me.
You can go to a duchy.
Yes, okay. Right? I didn't know.
I thought you could. Anyway. does it matter?
You can in Escaflowne, I don't know.
Right. Okay, so that's sort of the first half of the show. Personally, I think the pacing, I think what makes the show so popular, what makes this show such a beloved classic, even almost 20 years after it originally came out, it'll be 20 years old next year, is this first half. Because the pacing is basically flawless, in my opinion. Every single episode is a cliffhanger. You really want to find out what's going to happen next. It's exciting, and it's beautiful, and it's really well animated. I think the first half of this show is probably one of the best examples of, here is what anime can do when it's, like, really firing on all cylinders. I think it's kind of perfect. But I'm curious what you think. So, Hope, what do you think?
I mean, I don't have any argument there. I, it's, I, it's basically so tightly paced while still having that that nice, like, lulls and swells thing where it's basically, like, extremely entertaining chase scene where they're, like, showing you where everybody is at all times. The fight choreography is nigh on perfect. It's, like, packed with character. Like, Dillandow and Vaughn's interactions are fantastic. Alan and Hitomi's interactions through these fight scenes are fantastic. Merle's there, and you don't hate her. Like, Merle actually adds to scenes. Merle is a... Vaughn has a cat girlfriend, and that is such a 90s anime thing, but Vaughn has a cat girlfriend, and she doesn't really directly contribute anything to the story, but she peps up the scenes that she's in because they know how to use her. She's not, like, filler. You're not like, ugh, Merle, go away. Like, she's just used really well. So, yeah, like, the first half is so well-written and so well-paced. When there's not an action scene, which is not that often, like, when they're not having a huge, crazy, world-ending chase scene, the character stuff is really good. They're really good at establishing, like, Hitomi is kind of a dumb high school girl with a wavering heart. Like, it's basically, she falls into this fantasy world, and then she falls in love with Alan the Knight, and she's very self-conscious about this. She's like, oh, I just confessed to, like, a boy in the real world, and now I'm after this boy who's a knight. You know, but they look similar. I'm so shallow. That's the key. And she's very self-loathing about this, and I like that, because it's not trying to, like, diminish her for being a shallow high school girl. It's just, you know, it's very sympathetic, but it's honest about, you know, her being kind of a flighty young 15-year-old, 16-year-old girl. And, yeah, everything's just packed with character. You feel bad for Vaughn, because his whole kingdom burned down, and he's, like, he's a very peaceful soul, but he feels like he has to fight to be a man and shit, and... You know, Alan, we don't really know yet, but he's likable. And everything is just super tight. It's just like, wow, this is a really, really good fantasy story that's constantly entertaining. So, yeah, that's the first half of the show, anyway.
Right. And, Ashley, what about you?
I definitely feel the same way, that it was basically, especially when I was watching it, like, live, quote-unquote, on Fox Kids, it's like each episode has a moment that I just distinctively remember now. You know, like, episode one, it's, like, meet Vaughn, fight a dragon. Episode two, like, massive fight with Escaflowne, like, Balgus dies. Episode three, like, Alan and Vaughn fight. Like, there's always just some iconic moment. And then in between there, there's so much good character development between all of the characters, even the minor ones. Mm-hmm. Which I thought was actually interesting then in the movie that... You know, it like carries over somehow into the movie, even though it has so much less time to develop all of the characters that it put in there. So, yeah, I basically thought it was pretty perfect and was totally hooked as a 10-year-old, and I'm still hooked as a 25-year-old.
Right. Yeah. And they fly past really fast. Like, it, you know, I think I got through those first 12 or so in an afternoon, and it was just like, well, see you the next one. Well, got to watch the next one. Oh.
You have to know what happens.
Yeah, right. Then at about the halfway point, this is when the show, I would say, starts speeding up. It is pretty obvious that, so as the story goes, this was planned for 39 episodes. They condensed it down to 26, and they didn't take out any story elements. Mm-hmm. So nothing was taken out of a show that was cut in half. So, I think the last half is where you start seeing this happen, because everything gets condensed. You have episodes where, like, five or six major plot points happen in a single episode. Mm-hmm. You learn, like, five or six important things about the story. The story gets immeasurably more complicated as it gets into the second half. Basically, there's a little kid who turns out to be Alan's son that he fathered with Milena's older sister... Mm-hmm. Who is married to another guy. They get introduced to Dryden, who is this merchant, this wealthy merchant who's supposed to marry Milena. He's the only person who can call down the Hispano, whoever the hell they are, to fix the busted Escaflowne.
The Lost Tribe episode. I wonder Vaughn, if they're related.
Well, Vaughn gets somehow connected directly to Escaflowne. Like, his soul is connected to it, so when it gets damaged, he gets damaged. Things get kind of nuts. They get kind of nutty.
You haven't even mentioned Atlantis.
Yeah.
And, right. Atlantis so it's happens. Also it's also revealed that the source of power that everyone is talking about and chasing after is the secret power of Atlantis, and that Atlanteans were human beings that figured out how to harness the power of human will and turn it into a physical force. Mm-hmm. They used this physical force to create Gaia, which is floating around behind the moon. And Vaughn is a direct descendant. Vaughn and his brother Falcon are direct descendant of the Atlanteans.
Atlanteans are the only ones left.
Atlanteans are people with giant white angel wings. Like, that's the only distinctive.
Because it's the '90s and they're in an anime.
Yes.
Anyway, moving forward from there,
somehow
eventually the show it starts getting like my timeline starts getting a little confused here. So they get through all that Atlantis stuff. They eventually visit Atlantis. They have to go there because ultimately that's what Dornkirk slash Isaac Newton is actually after. He wants to harness this power of Atlantis, which everyone knows that this power that they're after is what destroyed Atlantis. Mm-hmm. Eventually it destroyed them. We don't really know how. It just did.
Just burned things.
It just did. It just burned everything down. But they want to harness this power again and basically make all their wishes come true because you can will anything you want into existence.
And Hitomi does this perpetually because she's... So the reason Hitomi comes into all this and the reason that she's a special snowflake and got transported to Gaia and everything is because once upon a time, Alan's dad had a liaison with her grandmother. And because of the power of Atlantis, like, they both ended up in the same place at the same time. And he gave her a piece, but he gave her the power of Atlantis, which is this tiny pink pendant, and she passed it down to Hitomi. So now Hitomi has it, and without knowing, she's actually been, she doesn't tell the future, she's not a really good fortune teller, she's actually changing the future whenever she does that stuff, but she doesn't have complete power over it because she's sort of a wavering, unsure high school girl, and she's also not aware that she has this power, so she... Basically, Hitomi is in control of all events, but it's all directly tied to her emotions, so everybody's screwed because, you know, it's tied to her emotions. So all of that is in, like, the first third of the first half of the show. And
the second half of the
show. Yeah, something like that. Or, excuse me, the second half of the show. Yeah. So, yeah, it's just, and it's like, you know.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And so, again, right, so that all happens, and then... we are introduced to, well, no, that's a little later. They wind up confronting Dornkirk directly, and he realizes that he's not chasing Escaflowne, he's chasing her. He's chasing her power, her ability. And then there's what I think is probably the worst episode of the show, which is where he decides to, get involved in Hitomi's love triangle between Alan and Vaughn and sort of... creates a circumstance using all of his fate controlling powers to get her to kiss Alan on a bridge where Vaughn can see it.
Where Vaughn can see it. Well, he specifically makes Alan. It's supposed to affect Hitomi too, but because she's kind of tied to this power of Atlantis, it doesn't affect her entirely. But he basically brainwashes Alan completely into loving her. He was on the brink, and then he just like boop tips him over the edge, which is really upsetting. But yeah, like, that's a really weird show. It makes sense. It's a weird direction for the show to take, but he's kind of like, oh, well, the problem is kind of the dragon, but it's mostly this girl. Really, the issue must be that they can't come together. They can't So this whole story is, in classic shoujo tradition, is hinging on these two can't fall in love. So Isaac, million years old, grumpy Isaac Newton, has to create a plan wherein these two teenagers don't fall in love, which is hilarious, but it's also kind of like, oh my god.
Right. So at this point, the show is basically cramming in kind of everything it can think of that has anything to do with divination or fate. And they eventually get to luck, and they introduce these two cat lady characters that are
my least favorite part of the show.
Are Falcon's? They're like Falcon's foot soldiers, and he creates like this hybrid, super fortunate, lucky blood and he injects it into their veins, and then they start fighting, and they've created like a field around themselves where the most fortunate stuff will always happen to them. So they'll get incredibly lucky all the time.
Yeah, when you're fighting them, if you're fighting them in your robot, a screw is going to pop out of your robot when you try to attack them, basically.
Right.
That's how it works.
And that's how he wants it to work.
Uh-huh.
But it's ultimately not how it works, because as it turns out, when you do that, you get an equal and opposite reaction.
Right.
And they will be incredibly lucky, and then there will be terrible misfortune for everyone.
Because everything links back to science. Even though it's magic, it's also science.
Yes.
Gravity and...
Sort of, kind of.
Kind
whatever.
Of. Right. Anyway, so that doesn't work.
Yeah, the ultimate end to that is that... I mean, yeah, we can talk spoilers, I guess. That was my least favorite part of the show, because the thing about the foot soldiers is, I mentioned that there was a cat girl, but specifically the foot soldiers are, I guess, they're Fokin's babies, and this is treated not very handily. Fokin, after running away from his destiny and joining the dark side of the Force, he adopts these two cat girls as, like, his charges, and they're supposed to be his right-hand ladies or whatever, but they are, they both want to fuck him, and they circumvent this by, like, making out with each other. It's super fetishized lesbian cat girls, and I got real tired of that real fast, because they spend a lot of scenes with them that are just, look how sexy they are, and how much they want to fuck Fokin. And they want to fuck Fokin. And, yeah, that got real tired real fast. And then they only exist for that reason, and then to be, like, killed off tragically so that Fokin will join the good guys. And that's their entire reason for that subplot, is that their luck blood eventually comes back on them, the most unlucky situation. They sort of shrivel up and die, and Fokin goes, all right, enough. Like, for some reason, my brother being in peril wasn't enough, but my two adorable cat girls are dead, and now I want to join the good guys. And so that's kind of where that comes from, and it's like, so that was unpleasant, but, you know.
Right. And then, you know, that sort of dovetails into the end of the show, which is, effectively, Fokin decides that he's going to fight the Zybok Empire, be a good guy, and help the good guys defeat Dornkirk. This is about when you discover that Dornkirk is Isaac Newton, who, after he, you know, what they, so the reason it's Isaac Newton is because they wanted a guy who was, like, sort of chasing the mysteries of the universe, and in his quest to turn lead into gold through alchemy, he determined that the powers that actually dictate the universe are fate and destiny, and if he can control those, then he can make a world without war for everybody. That sent him to, his desire for that somehow sent him to Gaia.
So we described the first half of this show pretty handily in a couple minutes, and it all made sense. You may have noticed we're barely through it, and describing the second half of the show makes you sound a little like a crazy person.
It does. It does.
I love describing this show to people. They're like, you're insane for liking this show. And I'm like, that's fun.
Right. Anyway, so you learn that about him, and at the end of the show, ultimately, is all of this fate stuff and destiny is all bullshit. It's not worth anything. It doesn't mean anything. So long as you still have your free will, you can do whatever you want. You can give into emotions and stuff, and that'll dictate what happens to you. And you can focus so much on an outcome that you will it into existence, which is basically saying, like, you know, there's a old adages about, like, predetermined outcomes based on your attitude, which is kind of what the show is saying, like, in a sense. You know, at the end, Hitomi says, I don't believe in predestiny, and this is all this is all crap, and you write your own fate, blah, blah, blah. Pretty standard stuff. Like, pretty standard stuff.
I like the way that this is characterized, which is by, we've established that Hitomi's emotions, it's not, she can't literally just say this will happen and it happens. She's not a genie, but her emotions dictate what the future is more so than other people's because she has this pink pendant. And she finds herself in a position where she's done all she can do and the world is now at horrible war and Dornkirk is kind of about to succeed in the way that he wanted to, which is burn everything, restart. And so she's sitting there, like, basically has all the power in the world but can't use it, and this giant fate machine is, like, turning out of control, and he's like, well, nothing can stop it now. And they espouse this your will is your own fate, doesn't matter thing by having Vaughn literally, with his big angel wings, fly through the machine. Like, so it's in a big glass ball, and he's like, pa-ching, straight through the big glass ball, and he's like, oh no, you broke it. It's like, that's all it took, just throw a small boy through it. So you throw a small boy who's in love through the machine, and he, like, picks up Hitomi and flies out of there, and it's like, oh no, true love, and then it blows up. So it's a great way to, you know, to espouse this without any, like, overbearing dialogue about how free will is absolute. Just have a ridiculous scene where somebody busts the machine through the power of love, you know.
Yeah, it's like, finally, my machine to control fate is complete. Somebody breaks it. Well, I didn't see that coming.
It's a little ridiculous, but, you know, it's sweet. And the animation in that moment, like, that's romantic.
I'm not saying this is bad.
The number of chicks that like Escaflowne, you know, it's understandable. It makes sense. I'm just saying.
Right. Anyway, so the show wraps up with Gaia sort of reunited under peaceful terms. They're sort of rebuilding, and then Hitomi heads on back to Earth. And Vaughn apparently can check in on her by, I don't know, hanging out at the bus stop or whatever. And then and then the end. And then that's the end. It ties up really quick and neatly, I would say. There's a few plot holes and stuff at the end, but... You know, they're cramming so much in at the end that it's,
the biggest
of course,
thing,
forgivable.
The biggest thing that bothered me at 16, I don't think there's many plot threads left dangling. They pretty much snip everything off. And,
yeah.
But the biggest thing that bothered me at 16 was that Alan never told, and probably because he's such a scrub, will never tell his illegitimate son that he's his illegitimate son.
Mm.
And it was like, you scrub. Like, that was my biggest, that was my biggest point of contention. But, I mean, that's not really a plot hole so much as it is a... Well, fuck you too, Alan Shazar, you know, kind of a thing.
So I guess that sort of begs the question. I guess I want to start, you know, sort of discussing this series. What did you think of it in the end? Like, did you have a different opinion at the end than you did at the halfway point? And overall, what's your takeaway from the show? And I guess, Ashley, let's start with you.
Okay. I mean, when I was 10, I definitely thought, like, the end was super deep and, yeah. like, thought-provoking in the way that it was, like, emotions control everything, and when people's emotions conflict, that's where hate comes from. And now I'm like, that's super basic, like, super obvious. And I think it actually has – I think it contradicts itself in some ways because I actually didn't feel like Dornkirk wanted everything to burn to the ground. There was one line where he was like, I can't believe these people can do whatever they want now, and all they want to do is fight each other. And I'm like, okay, so you didn't want that to happen, but that's what happened before. What made you think it would be different this time? Like, I don't...
He's a very bad genius. Like, he's like, I'm a genius, but it never really... No.
It never came
through.
He
never proves it, no.
Yeah, and it was just like, I feel like there was a, it's like it wants it to be about free will and emotions, but at the same time, the people that were doing whatever they want, it just seemed more like they didn't have societal expectations holding them back or like societal norms. They were just like, I want power, I'll go kill that guy, and that'll get me power.
It curiously
it's just
like
a short-sighted dream thing.
Why is the natural state of everybody at the end, like, I understand they're at war when the machine goes bloody-hoo crazy, but at the same time, for some reason, when the machine goes bloody-hoo crazy and they're at war, nobody's desired, I just want to be with my family, I just want to go see my family happens. Everybody suddenly becomes power-hungry, which makes me think that the machine, either the show is saying that that's everybody's natural state of being, which I don't think is true because what we see characterized in Hitomi and Vaughn and Alan's wishes, I think what it's saying is that the machine was bad, and therefore it wasn't what people really wanted. It just enhanced, like, the worst possibilities in people, and Dornkirk.
Right, I think that's true, too. I think it was, like, what people really want is ultimately peace, but, like, it gives them these short-sighted goals that are like, if I kill Delandau, then there will be peace. And it's like, no, that doesn't...
I think that's a good point, because the way it affects Alan and Vaughn specifically is it doesn't tap into their real wishes, which is, you know, I want to make peace with my brother and I want everything to go back the way it was in my childhood. And Alan's the same way. I wish everything was the way it was. They're both man babies, basically. They're both huge man children. But what the machine actually does to them is make them want to kill each other to protect what they love. So if I kill Delandau, there will be peace. You can't kill Delandau. Delandau's my sister. What? You know?
And then Alan's like, or Vaughn's like, you're actually crazy, Alan. That's insane.
Yeah. Well, which it is. Did we want to talk about that? Like, what was your reaction to seeing that? Because that was, I remember that being truly extremely shocking when I was 16. I was like, what? How? Why? You know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, sure. Of course. The thing I did want to say, though, in that discussion is that I feel like that kind of sums up that when Hitomi tells Vaughn, you don't have to fight him, you don't have to want this, and he stops. And that kind of sums up what the show's trying to say, which is basically like, your heart, you think in your heart you want this, you want to fight him, but you don't have to. You don't have to do this. We don't have to do this. You can just stop. You can just not want this. And he's like, oh, right. It's not predetermined that I'm going to fight this guy.
Mm-hmm.
It's not written in the stars that we're destined to fight each other. I can just say I don't want to do it, and I'm not going to. So that's kind of what the show is trying to get across there. But the Delando stuff, I did want to talk about the characters in the show, because upon rewatching it, I discovered I think Delando is actually the only really, really interesting character in the show. Everyone else is a little cardboard.
They're likable.
They're likable to an extent. I think my takeaway, I'm not saying it's the only good character. I'm just saying it's the most interesting by a pretty wide margin.
He's the most off of archetype. Everybody else is a likable archetype. Delando is sort of like, the more you think about him, the more interesting.
It's the most interesting character arc, and when he was on screen, the show was already exciting, and it gets more exciting when he's there. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
My hatred of Alan Chazar is like, it's pretty well documented. I don't like his character design, bothers me, and he seems like a m'lady, like a guy who would say m'lady and like
and
own
he
a bunch.
Literally say that.
I think he does say that. Yeah,
yeah,
right?
I'm sure he does. But like, if he were a real person, he would own a lot of replica swords and like have his hair like hair long hair in a ponytail and like try to pick up girls at anime conventions. Like he would be that guy. Vaughn doesn't do anything except get angry and frustrated.
He has
and
very powerful feelings about people he's lost.
Mostly anger.
Well, right, but he's not a violent person. Like, it's interesting. He's not like, I want revenge. Like, he says he wants revenge because he thinks that's what will make him kingly, but what he really wants is just, like, love and acceptance. Like,
yeah,
he grows
sure.
Acceptance.
I feel like most of the time he's just gritting his teeth and yelling about everything. And so, ultimately, I didn't really buy the romance between him and Hitomi, because it's not really developed all that convincingly. It's just they have a few moments where there's a little bit of romance building and stuff, but otherwise they just kind of, it's not like it is in the fucking movie where she just decides she loves him, but the TV show, I feel, I didn't quite buy their romance, and it wasn't a selling point of the show for me, even though it definitely is supposed to be.
Well, it's interesting because I think we have higher expectations. It is definitely, so compared to like Lord of the Rings or something, it's definitely enough romance for most fantasy novels in which a guy and a girl are in love.
Yeah.
It's definitely enough for that. Like, they have more going on than just, I think you look pretty, which is usually all you need for these kinds of big swashbucklers. But by the standards that we're really expecting, which is shoujo, yeah, it's not enough. We look at it and we're like, oh, is this a shoujo romance? And by those standards, usually they expect there's more chemistry built up, there's more, it makes more sense if it's well written. And this is a well written, like, swashbuckling adventure, but it romance wise, it's somewhere in between the bare minimum expected for a fantasy prince and princess in love and what we expect from like a well developed relationship. It's not quite enough to be realistic, but it's just enough to be believable for its genre, definitely. So it's a tricky,
Yeah.
The first half was definitely better at, like, develop. There were many more small moments in the first half that developed the romance. Then in the second half, it was just like, we're angry at each other all the time.
Yeah.
All the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And so, by the end, when they're like, we're in love, I'm like, are you? Okay. You know, like, it didn't really resonate with me. I appreciate the show most as a well-told, interesting, kind of crazy fantasy adventure that just happens to be incredibly well made. And in terms of like deep themes, not really. And in terms of like characters I love, not really. Hmm. Not really there. Hmm. I love the show. I think it's a classic. I think if you're an anime fan, you should see it. I think if you're a fantasy fan, you should see it. But it is popcorn. It's popcorn.
It's the best popcorn. This is the best popcorn. And it is, we should say, like, when we say the characters are not very distinctive or deep or complex, like, we're not saying they're not likable. Like, when I say swashbucklers, like, it reminds me of, like, a Pirates of the Caribbean or something like that, where it's like, these are very timeless, very easy-to-like characters. They do a very good job of giving them just enough traits where it's like, I know who this person is and I like this kind of person. But it's not like this is anime, and there's, with anime fantasy, there's a weird expectation that there's going to be more exploration. Even if it's not well written, there's going to be an attempt at more exploration than big fantasy Western archetype, and that's not what these are. These are big fantasy Western archetype. Right. So, yeah. Is fine.
Yeah. What do you think, Ashley?
I definitely like all the characters, and I, you know, had a like girl crush on Vaughn or whatever back in the day.
Right.
But I think some of the strongest things are like how they portray the side, like the super side characters, like Merle, Geddes, Jajuka comes out of nowhere and endears himself to my heart somehow. Like, I don't know. It does a good job of endearing you to them, but beyond that, you're like, I don't really understand Jajuka's like mind at all because I don't have any time with him. He's just like, he's somehow loyal to Delandau because
He
raised Selena or whatever and became Delandau from that, so...
What's funny, well, he looks like a golden retriever, so there are animal people in this world, and he looks like a golden retriever, and it makes you think of... And so he takes care of a little blonde girl in, like, a Victorian dress, which you don't know that, but that's what Delandau is on the inside. So, and when he meets her, that's what she's like. So, you see this dog person who looks sort of like a golden retriever that is... in love with and deeply cares for this little girl in a Victorian dress that's blonde. And it's like, oh, that makes sense. Like, I've seen that image before. So it's weirdly like calling up, you believe it because it's calling up like these natal images of things in your brain. You think, oh, of course the pretty golden dog will be in love with the, will want to take care of the little girl, the little blonde girl. Like, it makes sense, but you don't really, I don't know. It's in the back of your head. They don't need to establish why he care so much about her. It's just like, oh, this girl's crying, I will make her happy, that kind of thing. So.
Yeah, I feel like it takes a lot of those shortcuts with all of the characters. Like, it'll give you one moment where you're like, yeah, I've seen that story before, I now understand you as a character, and then, like, doesn't go beyond that. It's just...
Yeah, a lot of association. Well, there's really... The character designs and the scene design is so strong in this show, like, there's a lot of basic association. They know what images to give you to make you know exactly who this person is. Alan has long hair and a gentle smile and a pet owl, and you know what kind of person this is. You know?
I forgot about his owl.
Yeah. I forgot the owl's name.
His owl doesn't show up very often.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we should talk a little bit about the Delandau stuff. So it's kind of the strongest story arc in the show. Basically, they were fucking around with the fate stuff. Hard enough to have human experiments to see if they could change someone completely.
Mm-hmm.
And they took Alan, they kidnapped Alan's sister and turned her into a psychopathic killer.
Specifically male. Like, what they did was they actually changed her fate from birth.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. The most interesting thing I found about this is it makes more sense the more you think about it. It's clearly something that they had in mind from the very beginning, because when we learn Alan's backstory, it makes sense. Because Alan, after losing his family, Alan Shazar, before becoming a noble knight that's all cool and peaceful and stuff like that, he was like a wild jungle boy for a while, until Balgus, who is like this ultimate swordmaster, found him and trained him. He would have had a very similar fate to Delandau. He would have been violence crazed, despairing, lonely kid. And so the fact that that's what they very easily turned his sister into by changing her fate to be born, I guess, a guy and alone, which is what they did. Like, Delandau thinks that his past is orphaned wild boy. That's what Alan almost became. So it makes sense that his sister would be that way, too, if they just sort of changed who she was from birth. So it's interesting, like... but it's also funny because his character is so, like, shallow in a way that's more shallow than everybody else. Like, everybody else seems like they you know, even though they're archetypes, they come from a place of humanness and a past and stuff like that. And Delandau seems like he's following a script. And he seems like he knows he's following a script, especially when the spell starts to wear off. Like, he's like, yes, I want to burn things. I want to take revenge on the people I hate. I want to, you know, make snappy quips and slap my underlings. And then it sort of starts to wear off where he's like, oh, are we going to go destroy a village today? And Jajuka's like, yes, we are. And he's like, that's good. And he just doesn't really believe it. He's like, that's good. And, you know, and you slowly see him break down and it's really moving. And it's like, oh, you know, his real self has been taken away from him. And that's really sad. And yeah, he's a really good character, basically. And he starts out as just comical, psychopathic, cackling killer. So, yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. I think it ties into how most of the Zaibach people, at least all the main ones that we're introduced to, have, like, all altered their identity in some way. Like, Vulcan is missing an arm. Somehow that affects him very deeply. Mm-hmm. He gives his cat people, like, new names because their lives before sucked or whatever.
Yeah.
Isaac Newton is now Dornkirk because, like, whatever. And so Landau is just the most extreme case of, like, we changed your entire identity.
Mm-hmm. And there was a very brief character, but they, like, cared enough about him to give him backstory, and he takes up about 3 episodes. That is another, like, friend of Oaken's, a doppelganger. This is a species of alien. Like, there's animal people, there's other alien races on Gaia, and one of them is the doppelgangers, and it's this big naked alien guy with weird eyes that, like, all of his people look identical, and they shapeshift, but they shapeshift by killing somebody and sucking their soul out, and then they can look exactly like them and have all their memories and abilities. So being a doppelganger is suffering. Like, you don't want to be born into the doppelganger species. And, so he kind of sums up what Zybok is all about basically just from the beginning. It's like, this guy's identity is taking other people's identities and using them for money. And his backstory is, like, he was a mercenary in war, because that's what most doppelgangers do, is they're hired to kill somebody with somebody else's face. And he accidentally ended up killing his own brother, who was also doing a similar job, which, you know, what a coincidence. But it's all tied into the Zybok, you know, giving people different identities that take away from who they're supposed to be. And, you know, it's a nice world-building detail that they don't ever call out, but it's another thing of, like, this is good because it's simple stuff, but it's using imagery that ties back to associations in the back of your head with, you know, what a bad thing is, and, you know, tying all that together.
Right. I guess, that's sort of my final takeaway is that is, you know, the Delando stuff is the best material in the show. Otherwise, it remains a classic that now I have a full grasp. Now that I have a full recent grasp of the story, the fact that the last half is 20 episodes of story crammed into about 12 is very obvious. Like, it's very obvious and apparent. I don't think it ruins it for me, and I don't think it's particularly, like, wild or nutty. The stuff that happens in it is, by fantasy anime standards, I think kind of standard. Like, it's a little weirder than usual, and describing it is difficult, but the act of watching it, like, while you're sitting there watching it, I'm not so taken out of it by the goings-on that I'm no longer wrapped up in the show, if that makes sense. My reaction while I'm watching it is not, this is so weird. I'm just following the story, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think they seed all of the things early enough on that when they start to go off in crazy ways, you're just like, I accept that, actually. I totally accept that.
Yeah, I think it's grounded enough in pre-established roots, like you were saying, to make it so that describing it after the fact, you sort of realize how nutty the story is, mm-hmm. but in execution, it doesn't come across as being super weird. I know, Hope, you actually disagree with this.
Yeah, I think it does come across in execution as super weird when you approach it as an adult. I think when I saw it when I was 16, I still remember thinking it was weird and being confused, but not as much. I think I went with it more. I was like, yeah, sure, yeah, of course. But now looking at it, it's like, but I should clarify, but I don't think that makes it worse. It's weird. It's like the writing actively does become worse. It does become more compressed. It becomes more illogical. It becomes more bloody-hoo crazy. There are more side roads. There are episodes where Hitomi is going on a vision quest through other people's memories and literally teleporting around the world so frequently that you lose time and place. Like, because it's not just her, Vaughn and Alan, and like other characters are also doing this sort of vision quest stuff at the same time while they pack in info dumping and world building stuff. And it's not boring. Like, that makes it sound boring. It's so fast paced that it makes your head spin. You're like, where am I? What is happening? Why is the pendant doing this specifically? Because the pendant is not used a whole lot in the first half. One of the things that makes the second half so crazy is that they start using the fate powers overdrive. It's like, oh, we have this literal MacGuffin that can change fate based on your emotions, and we haven't really been using it. Now let's constantly use it. Let's never stop using it. And yeah, so I think it does make it crazier, but it doesn't make it worse, because you're still really entertained. You're still really invested in what's going on. It's not boring for a second. It's just weird. So I think, like, the best way to describe it is like, oh, Escaflowne is really good, but the second half is really weird. And be upfront with that, and I think you're going to get, like, the audience that will enjoy that show by saying that. If somebody's turned off by the fact that you say, no, you don't understand, the second half is really weird. If somebody's turned off by that, they wouldn't really enjoy it anyway. But if they're like, oh, this I gotta see, then they'll probably be into it. So, yeah, I mean, that's my takeaway from it.
Right. Yeah, whereas, I don't know, I think it's pre-established enough. The show never goes fully off the rails in terms of theme or character.
No.
Nobody starts acting wildly out of character. It doesn't get weird in the way I associate weird with anime, which is nonsensical and almost impossible to follow and completely at odds with whatever the show seemed like it set out to do to begin with.
Yeah.
That's what I sort of associate with weird, and I don't think this show does that.
No.
So, yeah. So some final thoughts on the show. One thing I did want to point out is that, so this is a Sunrise mecha show that is not Gundam. Sunrise has a long history of making crazy mecha shows that are not Gundam, where they're lavishly animated and the stories are kind of wacky. The most recent one of these was Crossange.
That wasn't lavishly animated.
But that's the lineage. That's kind of the lineage. That is what these shows have kind of become.
I would say,
over
like,
time. Valvrave the Liberator was another one, right?
Right. Well, I would think this. Well, it's different. It's like one branch that became even smaller branches. I think that the current strain of crazy wackadoo mech shows, and specifically their worldview, how characters are portrayed, how the conflict is portrayed, is actually a spinoff of Code Geass. But you can track Code Geass back to Escaflowne. So it's like if the tree was started by Escaflowne and it's like slowly drifts left, then you hit Code Geass and it goes hard left, and everything else has been a harder left.
Well, yeah, and Sunrise made mecha shows that weren't Gundam before Escaflowne. I just think this is as close to a modern. I think that's where you can kind of draw the line in terms of, okay, this resembles a modern show, and it's brightly colored and lavishly animated, like some of these Sunrise shows.
Yeah, definitely.
That are not Gundam, but mecha, and they try to introduce, here's a crazy world with crazy rules and magic, and here's a cast of characters, and let's see how long we can get it to run for, you know, that kind of thing.
Right. I wonder, like, now, see, I'm not a big mech fan, so that doesn't immediately leap to mind, but I'm like, okay, what were the shows in between, where Code Geass kind of defined the mold more, but the mold was already established, it just wasn't as narrow. What in between Escaflowne and Code Geass were the Sunrise mech shows that aren't Gundam?
That's a question for an encyclopedia, but right. You know, you can go back and trace those back, but
right.
It's just an interesting
might be
thing.
Interesting.
It's just an interesting thing to think about, that this was a prototype for, you know, what we're getting now.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to point out was in my discussions about the show over the last couple of days with Hope, I discovered that my nostalgia for this show and the feelings that I have for it actually clouded my ability to look at it objectively. Maybe not objectively, but it definitely clouded my ability to look at it critically.
Right. Objectively, it is out
to the
out,
point
yeah,
where
that's
I,
not possible.
To the point where I really wasn't. I've been doing this a long time. Like, I know what I mean when I say objectively. I don't mean free of personal.
People abuse the, you know.
But you know, critically is a better word for what I'm trying to say. This is such a formative show for me, and I have such warm feelings associated with it, and it's been a part of my adult life the whole way through, and you know, this has been my career for 15 years and stuff like that. Like, I was so emotionally sort of attached to this show or the idea of this show that I wasn't fully engaging with it as an adult. And previously I sort of thought, well, I don't really do that with things, but it turns out I do. And I feel like I kind of have to own up to that and admit it, that that's what I did with this show. And I feel a little bit bad about it, but at the same time, I understand where those feelings come from. And it's hard to criticize something where you look at it and it's like your first teddy bear. It's like your first teddy bear is sitting on a shelf and someone's like, well, that teddy bear is pretty beat up. And you're like, yeah, but it's my first teddy bear. I don't really want to hear about how it's beat up. Like, and I sort of engaged with it on that level. After I realized that, I was like, oh, that's, you know, those feelings are getting in the way of me being able to really critique this show properly. And it's just an interesting thing. I'm sure everyone listening to this has shows like that, where they mean something to them and have meant something to them for so long that it's really hard to get through the mire, the fog of nostalgia, and look at something for what it really is and whether or not it's still relevant now. I think it's important to hold on to those feelings. Mm-hmm. It's important to cherish something like that and have those nostalgic feelings for it and let it be formative for you. But I think if you're going to revisit it, if you're going to go back to it, you can separate those feelings. You can put those feelings in a little box and put those on the shelf next to your old teddy bear and then sit down and engage with the show and say, like, okay, this is important to me. This is formative. It doesn't mean I can't engage with it like an adult would.
Yeah, and you're right. Like, for you, that's very unusual, and I kind of discovered that when talking to you about it, that you would use different language, and you would be like, it was very, but my feelings. And it's like, and it's like, which is not, you have to understand, is not normally par for the course, Zach, at all. And I know that you, Ashley, you and I probably share a show like that. In fact, I'm very sure that we do share a show that we have those feelings. But it's like, yeah, we could look at this objectively and say it's a really ugly, like, old, dated thing to sell toys to kids or whatever. But we're just like, but my feelings. Like, it doesn't even matter. Like, all those criticisms don't matter, and we just could roll around in our feelings about the thing all day, about Digimon all day. But everybody has stuff like that, and it's interesting to, like, look at that stuff, and it's like, okay, but for the podcast, we have to talk about this critically and to try and separate those things.
And and ultimately, I'm never going to come down too hard on Ask a Flone.
Yeah.
The second half is really flawed. Mm-hmm. It's got a lot of problems with it, but I'm never going to come down too hard on it. I'm just not.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be like, yeah, man, fuck that. Because it doesn't,
you shouldn't.
I can't.
Yeah, you shouldn't. But you know? Like, I mean, Ashley, what's your take on kind of?
Oh yeah, I have the same thing with Zach. I think I've rewatched it with so many people throughout the years who haven't seen it. So I watch it with them for the first time, and they're like, "Ashley, this show is just batshit crazy. Like, why do you like it?" And I'm like, "But you just don't understand." So I've like had it slowly kicked out of me. The like, all right, I can see what you mean now, guys. Like, I understand it has flaws, but I have feelings from when I was 10, so but I'm going to acknowledge that they exist, but also I have feelings. So.
Here's this is a big thing here. So upon rewatching it, I think I can safely say that my nostalgia is not somehow making me like a shitty show.
Yeah.
The show isn't shitty.
No.
I'm not defending a piece of garbage.
No.
That's a piece of garbage. And
Zach, we understand what you mean.
Yeah, no, I'm just saying. But I've run into people who jealously defend something that sucks.
But one man's trash. Like, you would say that Digimon is trash, basically.
Well, no, I wouldn't say that.
Well, okay,
it's not for me. I'm totally ambivalent about it. I was too old for it when it aired.
Right, but you care a lot about art, aesthetic, and animation, and for you, those elements are so...
Oh, that show is so ugly, I can't
even say
that.
So there you go. So on that level, it's like, that's trash, but for us, it's like, but this is treasure, like, those things don't even matter. And everybody has different lines there. We understand.
But you can sit back and say, yeah, I can see how people might say this is ugly.
Mm-hmm.
And I can sit back from Escaflowne and say, yeah, I can see how people might say the second half is fucking bug nuts.
Yeah.
Yeah, because
it's out of its Falcon mind, right?
It is out of... Oh, damn it, you beat me to that joke. I was like, who's going to be the first one to make a Falcon mind joke?
Yeah. But I still would sit back and say, yeah, but it's fine. But I still like it. But it's still fun.
Yeah.
What's wrong? You know, that kind of thing. And so I wanted to make sure that I admitted to that, that this is one of those for me where my feelings get in the way of my ability to... It's not necessarily a rational reaction, but approach it like I would any other film or TV show, with a critical mindset, with critical thinking, and trying to sort of take it apart and say, okay, what is this show? How do the pieces connect? Does it flow? Is it well written? How's the pacing? You know, all that stuff. That stuff is harder, a little harder, when you're trying to penetrate the fog of nostalgia.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot of things to like about Escaflowne. I think it is not for every. I feel like the first half is for everybody, and the second half is not for everybody.
Second half's for anime fans.
They stopped airing it on Fox Kids. They were like, "We aired all the good episodes, basically, so you don't need to watch the rest. That's fine."
Yeah, see, I don't think that's true. I mean, I think that there's a lot of merit in the second half. It's just that it comes with. It's like, okay, this is gonna work entirely on character and theme logic, and it's gonna cram in way too much information, and you gotta go with it, you know.
Okay, so before we get to Twitter questions, we should talk about Escaflowne, the movie, which came out in 2000 and was actually Studio Bones' first animated feature. They didn't do a very good job. They did a great job animating it, but so this movie premiered at Anime Expo 2000. I want to say I was there for that. I remember people going crazy for the action sequences and otherwise being mystified that this movie had basically nothing to do with the TV show that they love so much. It's the same characters and they look the same, and it's Gaia and there's Escaflowne and all those, you know, the pieces are similar. Otherwise the story is completely different and the characters are totally different. It is as close to a cliche grim and gritty reboot as I think you can possibly get.
So we were watching it and we noticed if you remember the film, what popular fantasy villain in a popular 80s fantasy film does Fokin perhaps remember in his movie character redesign?
Man, I'm not good at, like, this game. I would say I just don't know.
We were thinking Jareth, like David Bowie. He looks exactly, except the blue hair. But, I mean, he looks exactly
his character
like
design Jareth. Is strange.
Yeah. And, well, once we saw that, we were like, you know, this rejiggering of the plot of the Escaflowne movie is kind of like if Labyrinth was about depression. And it's not a one-to-one, but that's a good one-sentence, like, approach to different this plot is from the rest of
the description of depression is basically this whole movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the Labyrinth thing, the reason that we sort of attach so hard to that is because Fulkin looks exactly like David Bowie in Labyrinth, and at one point, he's like, oh, well, I brought you here to this other world. You wanted to come here. This is what you wanted. Forget about Earth. Stay here. Like, that, it's exactly like Labyrinth. Anyway, the whole movie is exactly
like
that.
And she was like, I'm
never
suicidal.
Join you. Yeah,
yeah, but prior to that, she's like, I'm suicidal because I'm bored and my life isn't.
Yeah, well, like, why is she suicidal? I don't know. Yeah,
well, they just changed it. They just made, now it's about a story about a suicidal girl who goes to a fantasy world and gets over her suicidal depression because she meets a kindred spirit who's dealing with similar feelings and is hot and has angel wings. And
he also has magic powers now.
Yeah. The movie, I would say, is not... I am fine with that movie. I'm fine with completely different takes on stuff I already love. It plays exactly like an obscure, big-budget 80s fantasy movie that no one likes except for like a few people. It is just as ponderous as one of those. Stuff just happens. The movie makes fucking no attempt to get you interested in what's happening at all. Shit just happens. It just goes. It presumes familiarity with the characters and then does something totally different with all of them.
Well, you say it. Yeah, it's, you say it presumes familiarity with the characters, and at the same time, it is a standalone. Like the way it's executed, it is a standalone movie. It's written like a standalone movie from the 80s that is like, doesn't have good characterizations at all. Everybody is just a stereotype. There are too many of them. It's like a bad 80s fantasy movie.
And there are too many of them because it's like, you watch the series, you remember these people, here you go, they're right here. Like,
yeah.
And well, the biggest problem is just that it's joyless. Like, the series is so, like, full of happiness, I guess. Like, even when bad things are happening, like, it's
exciting.
Like, Escaflowne, you know, and, like, people screaming and, like comedy relief with Merle and stuff like that, which is not necessarily funny, but it's joyful. Like, it's happy and it's exciting and it's engaging. The movie is just, like, people that are dreary standing around talking about being dreary, but they don't have enough depth to carry it. It's just blank and flat.
The TV show is bright and exciting. The movie is dark and boring.
Yeah.
It's really boring. I'm surprised because it's only like 98 minutes long and they get a bunch of story in there, but it moves at a fucking snail's pace.
It reminds
me
of Earthsea. It reminds me of Tales from Earthsea, and nothing should remind you of Tales from Earthsea.
Maybe. Ashley, when did you saw the movie as a kid as well, right?
Yeah, I guess it wasn't officially released in North America on like DVD or whatever until 2002. Yeah. So I like got it then or whatever. Right. And I remember the first time watching it being like, what the hell is this, Vaughn? What have you just killed like 12 people within a minute. What just happened? I'm so confused, like in the beginning of the movie.
Vaughn series fights a lot but hates violence, doesn't like to kill anybody.
Yeah, exactly.
Vaughn movie is introduced in the first scene like decapitating people and smiling, and it's like,
yeah. Well, so like, how do you feel about the film now?
I mean, now I'm just completely confused about, like, I feel like it hinges on the fact that somehow Falcon got a bunch of power to form the Black Dragon Clan to oppose Vaughn and being the last of the Dragon Clan. But I'm like, how did this suicidal man, like, get so many people to follow him? Like, who would follow Falcon? Where did he get these people to go attack all everybody else?
I didn't think about that, but that's a really good point.
It doesn't make any sense.
Well, they don't explain any of that.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
They just want the Star Wars...
Because he literally just wants to destroy the world. So I'm like, why would people follow him unless he's selling a completely different message to them? Like, it makes no sense.
He's very jury. He's not very charismatic. Like, the thing with Dornkirk is that he came to power by literally, like, giving, like, a impoverished nation, like, technology and water and food and stuff like that. You get why Dornkirk came to power. Come to think of it, like, Falcon in this movie, like, why?
Well, it's what they wanted. It felt like the movie was obviously made with more Western sensibilities in mind, because Escaflowne was way more popular here than it was in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie was produced with a West... Not like, we're going to make this exclusively for Western audiences, but they decided what will be more international. What can we make that's going to have more international appeal? So they went with this shit.
Why? Anyway, because it's more Japanese, though.
But the thing with Falcon, it is a much more Japanese film. Pacing, shot-wise, like, shot composition, everything about it is much, it's, like, practically, it's so slow in some moments, it's like an Ozu movie, but, like...
The TV series is like, perfectly to Western taste. The movie is like, did you make this for a more Japanese audience? No, the reverse. What did you do? You messed up somehow.
But the thing with Falcon and Vaughn is, that's, they wanted that sort of Star Wars thing. They wanted the Empire Strikes Back.
Mm-hmm.
Moment. The thing is, the show did that. It did it beautifully.
Yeah.
It did the entire end of The Empire Strikes Back early on in the show, and it was perfectly paced. The sequence where they go...
I'm your bro.
Where they break into the fortress and Vaughn confronts Falcon for the first time. That's all the end of Empire Strikes Back, all in there. And they did it great. It's perfect. The movie just, like, dumps it. Like, hey, they're brothers. Isn't that fucking heartbreaking or something? And you're like, no.
Well, the best part...
I don't care about any
of this. Okay, so people don't talk about how much this movie is. Like, the other thing is, like, Escaflowne had... The series had themes. But it's more focused on entertaining you, having fun, you liking it. The movie is like, we're going to talk about serious shit. Like, it's up front about this is about depression and how about... And, like, and it's so forward with that. And, like, people don't talk about that. They talk about the movie being boring. They don't talk about the fact that it's a giant message like, film. But it is.
Remember all that fun you had? Well, now let's talk about depression.
Yeah.
Why? And, do we have to?
And what's funny is, like, so Hitomi is depressed. Vaughn is depressed. And Hitomi's solution to her depression is getting warped into this fantasy world where she sees a hot boy that is more depressed than she is and have more reason to be. And she's like, well, we just need to be together and that'll solve that problem. And the movie addresses this as if it's a totally valid solution to this problem.
It totally works.
That she fell in love with him instantly for no reason, and also, like, by going, I'll support you because your life is more tragic than mine, her depression goes away because it was just dumb teen girl ennui, I guess. But, like, it's confusing because then his solution to that is like, oh, so we can be together, I have to, you know, commit this act of hatred and vengeance. And she's like, no, you can't commit this act of hatred and vengeance because that will destroy the world, which is obviously a very big metaphor for suicide, depression. Like, Vaughn's depression will destroy Gaia. Hitomi's depression would cause her to commit suicide or whatever. But it's really, nobody cares. Like, nobody cares so hard because they didn't give you a reason to, and it's just so dull and lifeless. But in order to, the point I'm getting to is, in order to keep him from killing his brother in hatred and vengeance, and but still get rid of Falcon because he can't live because he's the bad guy, they have Jijuka, the dog we mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
Suddenly appear out of nowhere and kill Falcon.
It's such a cop-out.
And then it's like, it's such a cop-out. It's like, there we go, we got rid of him, and Vaughn didn't have to do any vengeance thing that will make him full of hate. And it's like, That is cheating. Like, yeah, your problems will be solved if some random guy comes in and does your job for you. It's bad. It's a bad film. It's pretty.
And it seems like a weak attempt to, like, Gaia seems so interesting, both sort of less in the film, particularly in the anime, where you get all these random beast people and the Hispano, and you're like, there's this whole world that they're not even exploring, and it's
still
exciting.
My favorite is the random dolphin guy in the market. He's like, hi, yeah, and he just keeps walking, and it's a walking dolphin, and it's like, what the fuck?
Yeah. So, yeah. Like, it does that. But at the same time, it always addresses that, like, the beast people are, you know, suppressed in some way, because you get, like, Narian area, Jujuka. And then in this way, it just seemed like such a cop-out to be like, yep, and Jujuka, you know, liberated beast people by killing this guy. And I'm like, what?
Mm-hmm.
And I just, like, didn't remember that. I was like, Falcon dies somehow, but I don't remember Vaughn killing him. Yeah. Oh, Jujuka comes out of nowhere. Thanks, yeah. Film.
Thanks, Vaughn.
Yeah, it's not very good. If you watch the show, I think if you're curious about it, you should check it out. I would be... Like, that sort of thing is insatiable curiosity. Like, if I watch a TV show and it's like, oh, there's a weird movie version that has nothing to do with the TV show, really? It's like, oh, I gotta see it. For curiosity's sake, and like I said, I put it on the same shelf next to, like, Krull.
Uh-huh.
Like, it goes on the shelf next to Krull.
Right, yeah.
Just for, like, weird, like, David Lynch's Dune. Yeah. It goes there. And if you're into that kind of thing, it's not bad. But as an Escaflowne movie, it sucks. It's not good at all.
The only redeeming thing is, again, like, the soundtrack, probably.
Of course. Yeah,
soundtrack for all of it is so glorious.
Yeah, I stand by the fact that I think Escaflowne probably has the best soundtrack of any anime and the best opening theme of all time, period, ever made.
Isn't there a track wasn't there a track on one of the releases where you can just watch the movie with the soundtrack only?
I think so, yeah.
They're like, we know.
Yeah, right. That's out there. Anyway, let's go ahead and get to Twitter questions here. So we got a few of them. Let's see. Okay. Ducknuts wants to know, what's the correct way to say Escaflowne? Well, I just said it.
You said it, yeah.
I used to say Escaflowne a lot just to get the people telling me angrily, excuse me, but then I got bored with that.
No, right. It's Escaflowne.
Yes.
Yeah.
Marked by Seven says, do you believe the manga was better than both the TV series and the film? No.
No.
I haven't read it, but no.
No.
It's not even better than the film, and yeah, no.
It's not. Okay. Super Neku says, do you have a favorite piece from the soundtrack? Jeez, a lot of them.
God.
I like Cradle Song a lot. And Dance of Curse, everyone likes Dance of Curse.
Of course.
Flying Dragon's really good. There isn't, like, really a bad track.
I have to say that I used to play the violin, and I, like, learned how to play Memory of Phanalia.
Oh, right.
Because that endeared me, yes.
Dance of Curse is the Escaflowne, the one where they chant and it ends in the big timpanis, right?
Yeah.
I love that one because it's, like, the perfect trailer song. Like, you want... If you like editing video, you hear that and you want to cut a trailer to it. Like, it's like, yes, that's perfect. So, I mean, like, yeah. And they ended a lot of episodes with it because it's great. So...
Yeah, they reused a lot of music in the show, but I think they, like... We have music that's, like, incredible, so... It's funny to me, too, because they would take... There are movements from the soundtrack where... It starts out sounding like it's an action sequence, and then it goes into this uplifting victory music.
Mm-hmm.
But they would start using the action part of the song for an action sequence, and it goes into the victory part because you can't really separate them.
Yeah.
But what's happening in the show is not congruous with the music anymore. So it's clear they were getting multiple uses out of these songs.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't always fit the animation.
Well, it was different. Sound editing was different in 1996.
It was, yeah.
And they... you listened to a lot of anime back then, and it's a lot of put the whole track in there. Like, Escaflowne actually has pretty clever, subtle, like, nice transitions in between music compared to a lot of stuff of its time. Now, it seems like they just plugged a track in there, but compared to other stuff in 96, 97, they really worked hard to make it as seamless and transitionary as possible.
Right. Okay. The Maraxmers asks, is it weird that my favorite parts of the film are the parts before she gets transported to Fantasyland? Not any weirder than having a favorite part of that movie.
I would say yes, because Itomi's time in the real world, I was like, I have no idea what your deal is. You're just sleeping on a roof. Like, I really don't care. Just don't care.
Yeah, they didn't. They don't do anything to draw you into that movie.
Yeah.
All right, Incompetent Crit asks, would you say this is more of a high fantasy series or a heavily stylized mecha show? I would call it a fantasy show.
I
would describe it to someone as a fantasy show. Mm-hmm. If they asked me what it had in it, I would say there are giant robots. They are not. You're not watching the show for them.
Yeah. Yeah. They don't care. They don't care much about how the robots work or what the different specifications of them are. That's there's like two kinds of robots, and how they work is really basic. And you know, it's not a mech show. If you're into mech shows, like there's a million other things. Like for the mechs, there's a million other things you would do before Escaflowne.
Yeah.
Like this show has never endeared me to want to watch any other mech shows. Like I have watched Code Geass and like Gundam Wing, but there's not. It's not like, oh my god, I need another mech show after you watch Escaflowne.
Yeah, it's not. That's not the draw at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Greatest G asked, did the show ever have a chance on Fox Kids? I don't think so. I think it's too serial. It's too serial. It's if it were to run on TV, it belongs in like a primetime slot. Like that's the audience that it's made for, but that audience doesn't exist in America for that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So no, I don't think it ever had a chance. Obviously it connected with you, Ashley.
Yeah. I think it connected with me because it wasn't the type of thing that should have been on Fox Kids, though. Like, I was like, how did this get here? This is totally different from, you know, it has a continuous story and, like, the animation is different and it takes itself way more seriously than most Fox Kids cartoons do. So, like, clearly it was not meant for that audience.
Yeah. Yeah. Rogue of Space asks, do you think the ending leaves room for a sequel series, or is the show best left as is? It's best left as is. We don't need more.
Yeah, you don't need more. Could you make a sequel? Yes. Would it be any good? But, yeah, like, is the ending open for more adventures in Gaia? Yeah. You don't need it. You don't need it at all.
Yeah. What else are you going to do?
Yeah.
They already saved the world. Who cares?
I don't even, if they went back and retold it over more episodes, I'm not sure you would need it.
No, and I wouldn't want that. I
wouldn't want it to be longer. Mm-mm. It's fine as it is. Mm-mm. Like, they get all their ideas in there, obviously.
Yeah.
They cram them in by the bucketful. Okay. BrackusJS asks, should an English redub happen, would you cast primarily a Texas or LA-based cast? So, the dub is bad.
Yeah.
I don't like the dub at all. It's really old.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it sucks. The dub on the movie isn't good either.
What's funny, Escaflowne's dub is not uniquely bad. It is, of its time, bad.
Yeah, sure.
It's just sort of flat and, you know, it's flat and contextless. The poor actors don't sound like they quite understand what the context of the scene is. It's, you know, it's a very, very anime dub, you know, in a bad way. I'd say it's not uniquely bad because, like, people can still, I'm sure, you know, you watched it, like, you were introduced to Escaflowne that way. I was introduced to Escaflowne that way. Even when I knew, like, this dub isn't very good, I left it on the English because I was watching it with my sister and she couldn't keep up with subtitles. She was 8 years old. So, you know, like, so it had its merits. It's listenable, but it's not good. So, yeah, it deserves a redub, I think, but it's not probably going to get one.
I had the VHS tape, so I only had the English for several years. So when I was watching it in Japanese this time, like, I remember how they say things in English and stuff, and I'm like, oh man, this is really bad.
Yeah. Well, the Japanese cast for Escaflowne is fucking all stars.
Yeah, that's
like
true.
It's either all stars or it is like people who would one day become all stars. Like, that's Maya Sakamoto's like first ish role. I think it's the first, one that wasn't, like, Walla or whatever. And then there's Joji Nakata's in it. I can't remember his name. See, I'm so bad with names. But the voice actor for Vaughn is Tomokazu Seki is a fucking veteran. Like, and then the woman who plays Delandau is outstanding. Like, it's just, gangbusters throughout the whole cast. So it's, you know, all people
so
who
poor English never had a chance.
Stuff. So it's like you're comparing a not good English dub that's kind of flat with a fantastic Japanese track. So it's like, you know.
Yeah. All right. Finally, Petpo asks, one more before we wrap up. Britain on the Shore asks, do you prefer the art style of the TV show or the film? I don't mind the art style on the TV in the movie. I think it looks fine. I wish that movie were better.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you remade the show using the movie art, fine. But I like the way they both look. Mm-hmm. I think ultimately I do prefer the TV show. It has a gradient airbrushed look. It's all light purples. It's all lavender and blue, and it's gorgeous art design. And the background design in particular is something you don't really see a lot of anymore. Mm-hmm. Hand-painted, hand-airbrushed background work that has a very specific late 90s look to it that I like a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the only thing I like more about the movie is maybe the beast people are a little more detailed. Like, the hyena people kind of look super hyena-y and stuff like that. But that's, I mean, for the most part, I judge the art on, like, character animation, which is technically animation, but it's also just how expressive these faces are. And the movie's a little stiff, and it's like, the character animation in the show is so much fun that I feel like it's looser and it allows for more. They're more expressive. So, yeah.
Ashley, what do you think?
I mean, I like the movie's animation perfectly fine, and everything's super fluid, but there's nothing, like, particularly special about it, whereas, you know, everybody makes fun of the noses and stuff from the show, but I'm like, no, I perfectly like it. It's kind of unique. It's more uplifting and colorful. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't change it.
There's a lot of great faces. Delandau especially has, like, fantastic faces.
Yeah, it's very distinctive.
Delandau's pissy faces.
Nobuteru Yuki, who's the character designer for the show, like, always draws, you know, big old schnozzes on most of his characters. And that show's no different. I just think it's very... Nowadays, it just seems very distinctive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but that's not bad. It's just...
Yeah. All right, and finally, Petpo asks, is Escaflowne's OST Yoko Kanno's greatest work? I think so. I am willing to bet Hope does not agree with that.
No, because it's not all her. There's a lot of whoever was her senior composer on that project. I forget his name. He's a little lost to time. But, like, a lot of his influence is in there. There's a lot of more generic tracks. And honestly, it's like, I think some of her greatest pieces are in that soundtrack. But also, like, she was still a little natal. Like, her distinctive sound wasn't completely, it didn't completely birth itself until later. So, like, some of her greatest pieces, some of her, like, this is, like, an encapsulation of the kind of music I want to make, are in that Escaflowne soundtrack. However, like, it, you know, she's still got refining to do. And also, like, it's not wholly her voice. Like, there's a lot of generic, like, filler tracks and stuff like that in there because she wasn't the only composer on the project. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think it's her greatest soundtrack. No, I think it's got some absolutely awesome pieces in it.
And, of course, Mystic Eyes, which everyone loves.
Oh, God.
Angel.
Yeah.
Worst. But the ending for the movie is so amazing.
Yeah, it's really good.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, Ashley?
I don't know if I follow composers enough to know, but I agree. I don't know that necessarily she, like, did all the things on the soundtrack. Like I said, I love the ending theme of the movie, which I think was mostly her, but, you know.
Yeah, that was a collab with Maya Sakamoto that she's done a hell of a lot since then.
Yep.
Okay, well, that actually wraps us up. Ashley, thank you so much for coming on and going over the show with us. I really appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was super fun.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Ashley for stopping by. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave us a rating and review. We'd really appreciate it. And we'll see you all next week. Oh, yeah.